Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And we have a really cool guest with us today. I'm with Martin Miller. We've been trying to connect for a long time. We finally made it. He just moved. I had a bunch of stuff going on, and here we are. And is it cold there today?
I wouldn't know because I'm inside all day. Yeah, but I got the heat cranked, so it's pretty warm. Probably cold. It's actually raining. So.
Oh, man. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Martin. A couple of quick announcements. I want to thank our mutual friend, Tim Miller, for connecting us. Tim, thanks very much. Also, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the show. If you're watching us on YouTube, if you hit the subscribe button down there somewhere and the little bell, the emoji that looks like a bell, that helps us get recommended by YouTube, and I appreciate your support for that. You probably know Martin. He's all over the web in a real good way. But let me give you a quick background. He's got a massive YouTube channel where this was interesting. You play like every style of music perfectly.
Fake my way.
I wish I could fake my way as good as you do. He's a solo artist. He also plays solo gigs and with his Martin Miller session band. He's toured the world on solo tours and with Tom Quayle. As a session player, he's recorded with Dave Weckl, Guthrie Govan, Stu Hamm, who we had on here, Andy Timmons, who we had on here, Tom Quayle, Federico Malaman, Eric Marienthal, and then the trio, Mark Lethierry, Kirk Fletcher, and Paul Gilbert. We had all those guys on here. Heaven Shall Burn and loads of others. And also Martin produces records as well. He's been a professor at the College of Music in Dresden, Germany since 2015. He's a very active teacher and a long-term product maker at jtcguitar.com. He has a double music degree in jazz, rock, and pop guitar, and a second major in music pedagogy. Is that all right?
Pedagogy. Music tuition.
You're actually the second guy I've had on the show that's got a degree in that. So it's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. Put it this way. This guy's super smart. I have to up my game here. He's going to use SAT words. You know the SAT exam here? You're right. Okay. It's like a college prep exam. He's going to be using these big words because he's super smart. So let's
just rock. Music smart. Only music smart.
No, I don't think so, man. But hey, thank you so much for coming on the show, Martin. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Hey, so tell me, how did you first get started in the music business, maybe? And what was your first break?
I think I got started in the music business. Well, I kind of transitioned. I was in college from 2004 to early 2010. And, you know, you do what you got to do to pay the bills as a student. You start gigging on the weekends and you teach throughout the week. And as I wrapped up my studies, that became more and more.
Okay.
Gigging on the weekend, teaching during the week. The average musician's life, that's how I got started. And eventually I got a little bit tired of that and I thought to myself, this is not what I want to be doing for the rest of my life. And I started by acquiring a camera and started putting out videos online and see where it took me. Because, you know, I'm not from a particularly vibrant musical place in the world. So I thought to myself, this might be a chance to reach people that I couldn't reach otherwise with my weekend type gigs.
Well, so you started your YouTube channel like on a whim then, just like, let me try this kind of thing.
YouTube back then was not quite the same as it is now. Nowadays it's a race, right? Like the meme race. Nowadays, when Bernie Sanders wears some funny gloves, you have the internet spammed with memes 2 minutes later and everybody is on it. And back in the day, that wasn't really the case. I think I uploaded my first YouTube video in 2007.
Okay.
And it's got like 5,000 views in a month, and that was overwhelming. And
wow.
The next, that, back then, that was overwhelming, right?
Yeah.
But next upload would be gosh, 6 months later, and then another upload 4 months later. It was not quite what it is now, right? Where you have to deliver content on a regular basis and everybody is in it. I was basically one of the very few who started putting guitar playing up on YouTube that early.
Wow. Interesting. So you obviously like it, or it pays you well enough that you're super disciplined to do it really consistently.
YouTube doesn't really pay me. Because most of what I do, what gets the views is the covers, and I could engage revenue share on those, but I decide not to, because a lot of people run into legal problems and copyright problems, content ID problems, those who do that. So I try to show my goodwill towards the copyright owners by just deactivating monetization from the get-go and doing the whole crowdfunding thing. Wow, so in a way, yes, I need to deliver regularly because I have an obligation to those who support me financially on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
So big shout out to my patrons. Those guys are incredibly generous and they keep the wheel turning.
Sure.
But yeah, so I have an obligation towards those to be putting out regular content. And also to myself, because I like doing it.
Yeah.
I want to show people new stuff that I've been working on.
Wow.
I'm very motivated to do that. Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you a question. This is like a question you never get asked in Germany. Where does that motivation come from? Because you are super motivated. I just mentioned that to you before we even started filming. Where did that come from? Why do you think you're that way?
Well, that's one of the things we learned in college. We learned the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. I think for me, it's very important to have a good deal of intrinsic motivation. So I like to make music for the sake of making music in the first place. It's just because, for example, when I record videos with my band, first and foremost, the prime motivation is to get together into a room with all these lovely people and have a couple of days' time to just do music together. Because when does that ever happen in adult life, that you get 3 days with 13 of your friends together, that's band and crew, 13 of your friends, and you just have 3 days to spend together and just worry about creating art? So that's the first and foremost motivation. The other motivation, of course, we get exposure for it. Our careers and our businesses improve upon that. So music is my only income. So there's a motivation not to starve.
No, totally.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, because I'm pretty aware of that, because this is not about me. It'll take a 2 seconds just to relate to that. For many, many years, I was a pretty popular marketing guru online. And what finally happened was, to be successful in that area, you have to be driven by extrinsic motivation of getting liked.
Yes.
And that is, that's totally not, I have zero of that. Like, I don't want to be, like, go out of my way to be disliked, but I don't give a shit, like, about... You know how many?
I wish I had that trait, that character trait.
Yeah, but I stopped doing it for that reason. It was just like, because it was, I realized that about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So
it's the thing is that the difference between the two is extrinsic motivation, you don't really have any control over, because what if the audience doesn't connect anymore with you one day for whatever reason? Maybe it's not because you've gotten worse or anything. Maybe it's just because what you're doing is not according to the zeitgeist anymore.
Right.
It could be whatever reason. The problem is when these factors that are beyond your control break away, what are you left with? And I think if my YouTube audience were to disappear overnight, I would still want to meet my friends and make music with them.
Right. And so that's where the intrinsic comes from, man.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. And I would still sit down and practice my instrument, or practice my voice, or practice keyboard, or produce music, because I genuinely enjoy the process, and it keeps my anxiety at bay. It keeps me busy. It keeps me occupied. I'm a video gamer. So video games and developing musical skills, there's some correlation there.
Yeah, I would think so.
And I'm purely intrinsically motivated to play video games just for the challenge.
Sure.
For the inherent process of challenging yourself. And it's the same with music.
Yeah. That's cool. Your English is like literally perfect. Did you, when you studied, did you learn in English?
No, I mean, I went to a regular high school here, German high school. And I mean, I was so immersed in music, and I was reading through lyrics all the time. And reading interviews. Back when I was in high school, we didn't have YouTube, so I was not quite as exposed to it. But all the culture I consumed was basically in English, and so I got really acquainted with it. And I got better at English than my teachers back in the day.
I'm sure.
It just took it from there. Nowadays, my life is English. You know, my girlfriend and I communicate in English. I teach every day. That is in English most of the time.
Right.
Now, I've had a mechanic here earlier. To him, I spoke German, and I might call my dad later. To him, I'll speak German, but the rest of my life is completely happening in English.
That's why. And you read books in English now too?
Yeah, I mean, most of what you can get out there is in English, right?
So yeah,
grab a theory book or something, music theory book or something, I try to grab it in English, even if it exists in German, because I'll have to communicate these types of things towards somebody in English at the end of the day.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I could tell that you read in English. You're just like I said.
To be fair, I'm a lazy reader. but even I mentioned video games, I play them in English because what happens? You want to look up a guide, and the whole internet is working English, and so I want to use that terminology. At this point, I don't even notice anymore. I remember my jaw used to hurt when I started out doing Skype lessons. My jaw used to hurt after speaking English for 2 hours, and that's gone by now.
Makes sense, because you're adapting to a different whole embouchure change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. That's interesting. I get the sense. Well, let me ask some. I get the sense in watching some of your videos, you're very passionate about music education. Like when you teach, I get the distinct sense that whereas some people say, hey, man, check this riff out, you actually want to make some sort of like cerebral connection with somebody so they understand the why behind it. Why do you like that so much? Because I think it's great.
Well, first of all, a lot of musicians see teaching as kind of a failure, right? So if I can't make the money playing gigs, then I'll resort to teaching. For me, it's not like that. I did work at private music schools for a while, and I hated it. But that's because the students you'd get, it was just kids who were forced to be there by their parents. So I absolutely dislike teaching somebody who doesn't want to be there.
Right.
And I'm not a good teacher. I'm not as much of a mentor as some other people. My strength is not to motivate people to get better. I'm really good at teaching people who have the motivation to play.
Yeah.
Already. And with those people who are just genuinely curious about music and about guitar, we can have a blast together exploring. And I like to dig very deep. So
yeah, you do.
Let me give you an example.
Great.
A lot of people will come to me who have a rock background and they want to infuse some jazz and fusion into their playing. And they want to get better at improvising. And what they expect, because they've been conditioned through internet education, what they expect is that I show them 10 cool licks.
I'm laughing because that's like, you know, the headline, it's like a, you know, it's almost like clickbait. 10 fusion licks you must know if you're a rock player. Yeah.
So. You know, that stuff is cool.
Yeah.
But there's no long-term reward for that.
Totally.
It's like that Confucius saying, give somebody a fish and you feed how to fish and you feed them for life.
Yeah.
That's kind of my approach to the whole thing. So what happens is somebody might be wanting to learn how to improvise, and I listen to them for a minute and maybe ask them a few questions. And sometimes it happens that I notice something as, okay, I'm giving you this piece of information, but it's not received in the way that I expected it to. And I sometimes end up just playing a note and say, sing this note, and the person cannot sing the note back. I was like, oh, that's the root of the problem. You're not hearing what you're playing. You're not audiating. You're not anticipating the sound of the note that you're about to play because you cannot match pitches with your voice. And we might end up just matching pitches on the guitar with our voice. And some guys or girls may ask themselves, what does that have to do with improvisation, with fusion improvisation? I want to play like Greg Howe. It's not an approach for everybody, because I always take the very long-winded approach that has the best long-term result. Because I think every shortcut that you take is equals a compromise of the end result.
Yeah, I agree with you there. For sure, man. That's cool. I also get the sense that you're a very organized, planned, and deliberate in the content you create and you put out. So first of all, are you, and then were you always like this?
I haven't always been like this. I used to be a much more chaotic person until I had to get my stuff together over the years. I'm a late bloomer when it comes to anything in life.
Uh-huh.
So my career hasn't started picking up till I was 30, honestly.
Right.
So I'm a late bloomer with anything. I was a late bloomer in high school. I was a late bloomer in college. I'm a late bloomer now. I'm somewhat deliberate and organized with what I do, but within what I do, I'm also very flow driven. So for me, it's important to just do whatever I feel like in the moment. Yes, I like to have a new performance with my band on my YouTube channel every month. Yes, I'd like to put out a record this year. I gotta get these things together. I have to have certain appointments, right? And I want to meet those. But at the same time, I'm usually very flow driven, and I try to take the path of least resistance. So whatever I feel like doing in the moment, I try to just go for, because that usually yields the best and most effortless result.
Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. So you're organized, but you're organic, I guess, is a fair way to say.
Yeah, I'm trying to be instinctual at the same time. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the. It's funny, man. I didn't learn that till I was in my 50s, so I don't think you're behind the curve at all.
Like, that's just even an example. Tonight, I got X amount of hours to spend tonight on work, and I either work on this new instructional product that I have. In the making, or I work on my new record, or maybe I'll go to the rehearsal room and work on my singing, or maybe I'll just grab a guitar and play. It'll be either one of those things. What it is tonight, I don't know yet.
Right, right, right. You'll know when you know it. Yeah. That's cool, man.
I'll just gravitate towards whatever I feel like doing. Yeah.
If you're comfortable answering this, and if you're not, that's totally cool. Of all the things you've done to grow your YouTube channel, for you, which strategy has proven most effective?
Ignoring any kind of external advice has been my strategy, to be honest with you, because you find all kinds of advice on how to grow your YouTube channel. Use these titles, use these thumbnails, use these upload dates, do this and that. Make sure you engage with your audience. Make sure you put a huge banner that says subscribe every other minute of your video. I'm doing none of that. Make sure your content is easy to digest and stuff like that. And here I am putting out 27-minute medleys. I try to ignore all of that. And in ignoring all of that, I've carved out a little niche for myself.
Good.
So I think just staying true to myself and doing whatever the heck I want has worked out for me pretty good. However, it took 12 years to take off. So my YouTube channel started in 2007. And it didn't take off till early 2017. So 10 years, took 10 years to get there.
But you know what? I think there's a myth around this. People think it's like a band. You know, you say, "Oh man, these guys came out of nowhere," and they just, you know, you're not thinking about the 10 years they were traveling around in a van driving through northern Michigan in the freezing winter.
That reminds me of Snarky Puppy. For example,
yes.
You get the Grammy for best newcomer, I believe. And it's like, we're not really newcomers, but thank you.
Yeah.
And it's like,
right.
They've been sleeping on people's couches and floors for a decade.
Yes. Yeah, man. Yeah. That's a great example. Yeah. But good. That's cool. It's funny because I'm a my business is marketing, right? So I always look and read things, and I'm the same way. I've been in marketing for 22 years, and I've heard, you know, I used to hear things like, don't put more than 7 words in your headline. I've written sales letters with 25, 30 words that have really crushed. I, you know, certain things you have to, if you have something interesting to offer, people will listen and read. If you're boring, there's nothing you can, you could put as many banners up there as you want. If you're not interesting, it doesn't matter.
That's actually a great piece of advice I would give to somebody who's wanting to do that sort of thing is, you know, you can read and study all these algorithms and hidden mechanics behind YouTube, but don't forget to work on your actual product. Yeah. That is bar none the most important thing.
Yeah, totally, man. Yeah, that's the content. You're in a content. You're creating content.
Yeah, I really wanted to avoid the word content because I'm totally dating myself here, but I dislike the word content because it kind of brushes over everything. I feel like I'm doing content. I'm making music. I'm a musician. I make music, and my music doesn't come on the radio. My music doesn't come on TV. My music can be heard on YouTube or on Spotify or wherever.
Yeah.
So to call that content with, hey guys, here's 5 tips on how to fix your dryer. is that really the same thing? I don't know.
I totally get it, man. I totally get it. Let's talk about some of the artists you've played with, and I'm going to bring up a few people. Talk about how you wound up first connecting with them, and if you have a cool or interesting story about working with them, be great. Let's start with Snarky Puppy, Mark Lethierry.
Yeah. So Mark, I first heard of within the Snarky Puppy realm. I heard the song Thing of Gold. That must have been 2014 or something like that, I guess. Was really amazed by the music. I absolutely love the kind of music they do because they take jazz and fusion and bring it into the new age, but their music is very honest at the same time and not overproduced like a lot of other music that's being put out now. As I really appreciate that commitment to honesty in their music. And so I obviously became aware of their guitar player, who's a freak of nature. And he was just one of those guys I really wanted to get in touch with. So I shot him an email, and I was lucky enough that he already was familiar with who I was. And so we got hit the ground running really, really well when it came to the communications. I invited him over, and the cool backstory with him is that he actually came, we didn't even realize, but I booked a flight on his birthday. So his birthday last year, his 36th birthday.
Yeah. He's around your age. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He came flying over from Texas to be doing 3 days of recording with us. And I call that commitment.
Yeah,
and
that is.
We had a birthday cake waiting for him. But he's one of those guys. He didn't mind at all. And he didn't make a scene at all. It was just so, so easygoing, such a natural flow, despite him missing his birthday.
Okay, he's a real professional, total pro.
Real commitment. Real commitment right there.
Any funny stuff or interesting stuff about working together?
Oh, wow. Is there any funny stuff? No. Well, he's the oddity is that he's the only guy we spent 2 days in the studio with, because we've actually flown him in. Anybody else we've been catching on tour and kind of bringing him. And he's actually the one guy we spent $3,000 or so on a flight ticket.
Yeah, they ain't cheap.
Yeah, and yes, there is a funny anecdote. At the end of the last day, so we have 1 day of setting up, two days of recording. At the end of those, you're just completely smashed, and he's on top of that. He's completely jet lagged and everything, and just so we spend a considerable amount of time at the last day at the mini bar of the hotel.
We were right on.
Eating the last piece of his birthday cake, and man. We had so little sleep because we had to catch his plane the next day, and so I had to drive him to Frankfurt, man, and I barely made it.
Oh, wow.
We had to stop like 8 times along the way because I had to take like mini naps. I was really worried to get this guy home safe. It was horrible. We were both completely knocked out and was just barely hanging on to the wheel. It was horrible.
How far?
I was not drunk driving.
Oh no, I didn't.
Just overly tired and
that's beyond wild. Tired. How far is Frankfurt from you?
Well, from the studio, that's like normally would be a 4-hour drive.
Ugh.
It took us like 8 hours.
God, that's a long 4 hours is a long drive after 3 days of nonstop work. I mean,
not for you US Americans, I guess that's a little more normal, but
No, but your roads, my wife's from England, so I've been on those roads there, man. It's not like it's not like getting on 95 or here or, you know, 275. Oh,
that, Ross, that's a complete highway. It's highway. But still okay. takes forever.
Yeah. Paul Gilbert, great player. Paul,
yes, what a legend. He was actually not easy to get in touch with because I just had this dream. We were just really talked about in the band who we want to bring on. It was Paul Gilbert was a name that kept coming up. And we just didn't know who to get in touch with. So it was like I had to pull all the strings from the Laney guys, the Ibanez guys, to get some kind of email until to our drummer, Felix, he knew his drummer, Thomas Lang.
Okay.
So that's how we kind of – and he used – actually, Felix and Paul used to play before.
On
the dates in Germany. So we got in touch with him, and it was – the whole organization of that was just a big old nightmare because he was on tour, and his tour plans kept changing. And it was honestly until the last 2 or 3 days before the recording session, I didn't even know whether it was going to happen at all.
Oh.
But he came in, I think he had a gig at the Guitar Summit in Mannheim.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
On Saturday night. And then he had a gig in Prague 2 days later. So our place was right in the middle of those two spots. So we managed to grab him and drag him into the studio. And it was amazing. I mean, he's just like in the instructional videos, and it's actually not quite because he was really tired when he came in, and he looked a bit pale. He was probably underslept. He was wearing regular street clothes. It was very quiet, and then he went into the back room, started changing clothes, and started putting on the suit, and he plucked into the Marshall amp and did the Pete Townsend whirlwind. Windmill, and this was the first time this happened. We didn't even agree which song to play first or anything like that. It just kind of happened. He started playing his song, and we started playing along. I was giving signals to all the camera people, get the cameras rolling. We got to catch this. And he just started playing. It was completely going crazy. He started playing with his teeth. Was playing the guitar behind his back. He went completely crazy from being super quiet and reserved to being an all-out rock star within an hour or so. That was quite something.
That's really cool. How many cameramen?
Yeah, to see him work his magic. Yeah. Yeah.
How many cameramen do you usually have in on these sessions?
So we have like 10 to 14 cameras.
Holy shit.
And we have like 4 or 5 people operating them. So we have 4 or 5 people manning the cameras, and they also switch on all the static cameras. And then we have one guy, and that's usually my pops, who's working behind the scenes and taking all the data and storing it, backing it up, formatting the SD cards and giving them back and keeping it all organized. Then we have an audio guy who only does audio, and that is a tough job.
Yeah.
As well. So yeah, we're like 14 people overall. With 10 to 14 cameras, it's a big production.
Yeah, man.
For an indie project, yeah.
Hang on 1 second. How much of that? How much do you have to get involved in? Like, are the camera people autonomous, or do you have to sort of like, hey, make sure you capture this, or do they kind of know the deal?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because I remove myself from that more and more as time goes on. At the beginning, I was very involved.
Yeah,
like I wanted to. Every camera angle, and I wanted to double check everything because I have a very specific vision about how this stuff is supposed to be filmed. Like a lot of these types of videos that are done on other YouTube channels, let's say, they're often, and I've taken part in those types of things. It's just one guy with one camera and you film the same performance 15 times over, and then you put together the imagery. But we actually don't use any B-roll footage. It's all live in the moment. So we have a camera on everybody plus a bunch of movable cameras, so we catch everything. So if our bass player decides to play a kick-ass fill in bar 1666, then we have that on tape for sure. And at the beginning, I was getting very involved with that also. And I still keep giving advice and improving because I'm also editing the videos.
That must be.
So at the beginning, we would have guys film just the chin beard, and you couldn't see of me, and then couldn't see what my hands were doing or the hands of our keyboard player were doing, and we had to kind of communicate how this should be filmed. And we started like incorporating Steadicam that does these long rides. And oftentimes before we record, we talk about, you know, there's this guitar solo. And after that guitar solo comes a huge drum fill. And then I start singing. So start on the guitar solo, go over to the drums, and then make sure you turn around to catch me in bar one when I sing. And all the camera people are musicians.
They are.
All of them are musicians.
So that helps.
Guys who are professional camera people, but they're also all musicians. So they know what to look for.
Wow. And you do the editing on all this.
I do the audio mix and the editing as well.
Yeah. Fuck, that is a ton. Filming is nothing. Editing, it's like, that's right? That's where all the work is, man.
But man, those cameramen, they have a brutal gig, honestly. Yeah. We do 27-minute medleys, which are filmed in one take, and they have to carry those cameras for 27 minutes at a time, six times in a row for six takes or so.
Yeah.
So that is brutal. And you know what? Actually, on the big productions, I have a cue track running on the in-ears. So the cameramen have in-ears, so they hear what we're playing it. And sometimes it'll say on the cue track, drum solo, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Okay. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes prep work for this.
And there's no B-roll footage. What you see is what you hear in that moment.
I just want to point out, a lot of people in general, they're afraid to do stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they might look at your channel or something else and say, well, I can't do it like this. But, you know, I just want to point out, you didn't start like this. This is an evolution of 10 years. You know, and the worst thing you're going to do is always the first thing you do, you know, and then the next time it's a little better and so be open and to just not failing, but just be open to doing it because you make changes all the time. I'm sure and you also, always make changes.
Yeah. And also I think this is a very typical male attitude is a lot of us think that unless we're the best at doing something, it's not worth doing at all.
Right. Yeah, but you don't get to be the best.
That's a toxic mindset.
Totally.
I'm not even remotely the best at anything I do. Mm. But the combination of what I do, you know, I play guitar, I sing, I do video editing, I do audio mixing, I do production, I arrange those things. The combination of that is what sells it, I think. So yeah. I've tried to basically come up with something that uses all the skills I had. Have not just the one skill.
Yeah, and there's enough people out there that someone's going to gravitate to you, mm-hmm. you know, and hopefully a lot of people gravitate to you as they are in your particular case, you know. But this thing about the best, I agree with you. It's just do the best you could do. I mean, that's my approach. I always try to do the best I can do, and I don't give a shit. Like, is it? You know, better than someone else. I don't know. That's not for me to decide. And frankly, it's none of my business, to be honest with you.
Or as long as you keep moving into the right direction, it's
totally. Yeah.
So I don't want to be the best at anything. Or I tried to be that for a while and I think it rubbed off on my music and I wasn't connecting with my audience.
Yeah.
And I think around the time that I stopped trying to be the best and I just let things happen a little bit more, people started connecting with what I do.
Very cool.
A lot more. And I think becoming better from where you're currently at, that is enough of a pursuit.
Yeah, that's a great goal. Yeah, I want to be better tomorrow than I am today. Man, I agree with you there 100%, man. Go back. Let's go Kirk Fletcher.
Kirk Fletcher. That was our most recent guest. We had him over in October last year. So.
And he lives in
Switzerland.
Switzerland, right.
Yes. And for me, like there's a ton of great guitar players in Germany, but this kind of project, and I really want to have an international vibe with it. So I really like to have somebody over who has a different cultural background from ourselves. I think that's really important. And luckily Kirk lives in Switzerland. We've been chatting back and forth over the years that maybe he'd want to come over one day and luckily, he lives in Switzerland, and even though we were just on the brink of lockdown, we did it right before lockdown. Really, 2 weeks later, we couldn't have done it. We were able to fly him over from Switzerland and have have that session with him. And it was so sweet. He's such a beautiful, beautiful person. And I regret to this day that we could neither hug or shake hands. And we also only had like 7 hours to spend, and then he had to make his way back. So we didn't even get a dinner together.
Oh, usually, man.
We get like a dinner with everybody together after and have a great time. So that was all missing this time. There was not quite as much human interaction, because even when we were eating, we had to be really far away from each other. And that was kind of a shame. I wish we definitely got to make that happen again. And
that's cool.
And include all the human needs.
Yeah. Totally, man. Kirk's a funny guy in that he never plays the same guitar he plays a guitar for a while, then he plays another guitar for a while, and then you may see what guitar did he play? Did he bring with him?
I think is it a David Grissom signature model from PRS?
A PRS? Yeah, yeah.
That's a PRS. Yeah. He's been playing a lot of PRSs of his late, but what I really love about Kirk is you can just tell what a humble man he is. He showed up with a guitar on his back, and he had a handbag made of fabric, and there was two pedals in there, loose. He just put those on the floor, put two cables in, plucked himself in, and that was it.
That's it, yeah.
I organized an amp for him. Yeah, no, that was it. But I loved how the pedals were just loose in the back, instead of having a super elaborate multi-layered rig. And I just love that type of approach.
That's cool, man.
So easy and organic.
He's a beautiful player, man. He's a great. Great blues player.
It's a lot of people ask us to bring these kind of super fiery shred players onto our show, our little show. And I have definite plans to do that with these types of players. But what I really like to do is bring players in that do something that is very opposite of what I do.
Sure. Yeah.
I think Kirk, from all our guests, Kirk has probably been the furthest on the other side of the spectrum,
yeah,
as myself.
Yeah.
I think that's where the magic happens. Somebody has been commenting on this one time. It's just like, wow, this is the first time a shredder and a blues player get together and there's no arguing or something like that. And I thought that was really beautiful because it really shows, you know, he does something completely opposite of me and vice versa. And we have an amount of respect for each other. A really high degree of respect for each other, and we enjoy making music and creating together.
But I get the sense of a big part of what motivates you is this opportunity to maybe stretch beyond what you would normally do, and having somebody who's totally opposite gives you that great platform to do that.
Honestly, I even forgot that earlier. Probably one of the biggest extrinsic motivations is that I get to play with a ton of my heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
I have a good reason to phone them up and ask if they want to make music with me. I wouldn't have a reason otherwise if it weren't for that platform and that format, for that studio, that crew, that band.
Yeah.
It's just a really great excuse to get those guys over and spend a day with them.
I know exactly how you feel, because I feel with this show.
It costs a lot of money, but a lot of people will go on vacation and Mallorca or Lanzarote or somewhere. That's where Europeans tend to go. And I make my memories that way.
Yeah, that's cool, man. Is there any other gigs or any performances that you've done that you'd like to talk about that were special or nostalgic or particularly memorable to you?
Oh, wow. There's plenty of that. I have a really bad gig story if you want to hear.
Yeah, go ahead. Whatever you like.
that one stands out in a negative way. We talked about all the great stuff now, about the bad stuff. Like, do you know the Tremel No system?
Tremel No?
It's essentially, if you have a floating bridge on your guitar, you can put that in the back and it blocks the bridge.
Okay.
So you can get a fixed bridge. But the cool thing is you can unscrew it and it becomes a floating bridge again.
Okay.
You can move back and forth. I just had that installed on a guitar and I did my first gig with it. And somehow it was either not properly installed or I messed up in how to operate it or something. It was a gig with a gospel choir. So there was like 40 people on stage. And
where was this?
This was somewhere in the depths of Germany, in, like 12 years ago.
The depths of Germany.
I don't even know where. That's how insignificant it is.
Okay.
I was a fairly big gig. It was like 1,000 people in the hall, 40 right. people on stage. And I have one big guitar solo, a written guitar solo. It's written on a piece of paper, and it's 32 bars long. And it's a ballad, and it's very sparse accompaniment from the band. And it's mostly whole notes, notes held out. So you're really exposed in that moment. And I walk to the middle of the stage to take the solo. I've been playing the fixed bridge mode the entire time because we're also doing some country stuff. So I was doing some pedal steel bends and all that stuff. So I detach the screw and I play the first long note. And I was like, oh yeah, let's come on. Let's put some vibrato on it. Grab the vibrato arm and the thing gets stuck.
Oh my God.
The system gets stuck and it just displaced the whole guitar by a half step. But as you know, tremolos don't displace the notes accurately. So it's not like it's just every string is exactly a half step lower. It's a complete mess. And there I am in front of 1,000 people and a full-blown choir and band behind me in the middle of the stage grinding out those 32 bars. It was just, oh.
Oh, my God. That's
You know what you do? You kind of have the melody for that thing in your head, so you try to fake it on one string, kind of.
The one that you got a handle on where the how far off it is.
Pitch,
yeah.
Where the pitch is. Just, oh, that was so freaking embarrassing. And like, you know what the worst thing is? That was right before the break and before we went back on stage. And so, of course, the entire choir and band meet backstage, and there I am having just pulled off that solo. It was just, what I didn't know is sometimes that thing gets stuck and you had to yank it one more time and it goes back to where it was supposed to be.
Oh.
I tuned it. I then went back to my place full of shame. I tuned it back to normal. And I used the vibrato bar one more time, and it yanked itself back in, and the tuning was completely off again. It was just it was a nightmare. It was so embarrassing.
It's interesting how I could relate to, because number one question, I guess, what's your favorite show? I don't really have one because I've had like 800 shows.
That's why I couldn't answer that. There were so many great ones, but this one stood out as a really sore one.
But I remember the worst one. It's so funny. I'm not going to talk about it, but I could zero in on because it was just like complete misery, man. So I get it. Tell me the top three musical experiences you've had.
All right. I think number one, or very, very much up there, is the first time I saw Deep Purple live. And I was, I guess, 12 years old. Was it 97? I think it was in 97. So it was Steve Morse on guitar, but there was like three bands opening up. And around that time, I just started playing in my school band, and we did a bunch of Deep Purple covers as well. And I only knew Richie Blackmore, Santana, Eric Clapton, those types of players. And I thought I was pretty hot on guitar. I had quite the ego. And then I saw these guitar players from the opening bands. I was like, holy shit, these guys are incredible. Wow. And then Steve Morse comes on last, and it's yet another five levels higher.
Yeah.
It's like, I honestly, that day changed my view of the world, because I thought something was established in a way that I knew it was. And then something happens right in front of you that challenges everything you knew. And so I ate the biggest humble pie ever that day, seeing Steve Morse play. And I went home, and I remember my mom asking me, so how was it? And I was just, I was like, I don't know. I couldn't answer that. I just still had to take in what I just witnessed. And that stayed with me up till today, that concert. I was still at very, even what 24 years later?
Yeah.
Pretty strong memories of that. So that is a big one. Yeah.
You ever met Steve?
Yeah, a couple times, yeah.
I had him on here. He's such a about humble.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. He's
an absolute hero of mine. Yeah. I hope one day that I can get him over and play with us. That would be a dream coming. I would probably cry on camera if that happened.
I don't see why he wouldn't.
Yeah, I've never asked. So maybe
You should. He would. He lives here in Florida. He's such a nice.
Yeah, I know.
Such a nice guy. I mean, you know, he's like the guy
he's a complete gentleman to me. every time I met him. So
yeah,
he's actually, he's probably a little uncomfortable because I rarely ever go into fanboy mode ever. But I remember the first time I met him beyond my teenager years. I was like, it was hey Martin, nice to meet you. I just went up to him and hugged him. Pretty uncomfortable.
That's so fun. You know, I was like that. I had Ian on the show, Ian Pace.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and I was totally in fanboy mode. I said to him at the beginning, I said, man, I just got to get this out of the way. I'm really sorry, but I just want you to know I feel like I'm 15 years old right now. Mm-hmm. You know what he said? He was so cool. He goes, Craig, don't worry. When I'm on stage, I feel like I'm 15 too. And I was like, wow, how freaking cool is that guy, man? I got goosebumps. He was like, holy shit. All right, Steve Morris, next two. Top musical experiences. Could be you involved, could be whatever you want, like this one you just mentioned.
I mean, let's go back to the olden days when you were buying records. I remember I must have been 16 and I bought Scenes from a Memory from Dream Theater, mm-hmm. from one of the local stores, and we had a CD player in the car. But I really vowed to myself not to put it in the CD player on the way back. I wanted the full experience.
Right.
And so I went into my room and I had a Discman to put my headphones on, put in the CD, and I laid on the bed, listened from start to finish, completely in awe. And then I rewinded the whole thing and started again.
Yeah.
Start to finish. So listening to that disc start to finish twice in a row, that is a thing that just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, that yeah.
Very intense music.
Yeah. I felt that way when I heard Dark Side of the Moon the first time.
Yeah.
Pretty intense.
I can imagine. Yeah. Yeah. Probably a very different experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, in general, back in those days, I had a commute. I had to take a bus to school that took like 30 minutes, plus a 10-minute walk to the bus. And I would spend every single minute of those commutes listening to music and just having extremely intense emotional experiences where there was a bunch of kids around me being silly. But I was having these super intense moments amongst everybody. It was just,
yeah.
Because I was not socializing at the time. I was just completely immersing myself in the music.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Anything else?
Anything else? Singing with the band for the first time.
Talk about that, because this is a newer thing for you.
So I started singing late. I started singing at age 31, and I really looked back at I had this kind of phase where I went back through the music that influenced me in my early years, and I thought to myself, if I ever make another record, it's got to be something like that. I want to recreate that feeling that I had when I listened to those Pink Floyd records, those Queen records, those Dream Theater records, those Toto records. And I knew that I didn't want to do another jazz fusion record or something like that. I wanted to make the music that really struck me when I was young and that took me on that whole journey of becoming a musician. And part of that was it had to be vocal music. And I know a couple of singers, but there was something looming inside of me. I needed to do it myself somehow. I heard a call inside of me that said, hey, you got to do it yourself. You got to do it your way. And so I just started picking up singing. And about a year later was the first time I sang in front of other people. That was when we did the Pink Floyd medley.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely crapping my pants singing in front of the others because I was really, really shy about it. And that was an extreme experience. So that those kind of nerves I hadn't had in a long, long time.
What did you learn from that?
I learned what it's like to be a beginner again at age 31 when I have a fairly good grasp of my main instrument, but that set me back to the very early stages. I think it made me a better teacher. It made me, I think, a better composer.
That's great.
It made me think of music I think it changed my artistry a lot because it made me think about music more as an artistic statement than as what cool stuff can I do on the guitar and put it out as a record. I'm really with my new record that I'm working on, the vocal record, I'm really trying to recreate that experience of listening to Dark Side of the Moon or of listening to Scenes from a Memory or that kind of thing. Not that it's a conceptual record, but it's, I think it has some of that nostalgia that these records evoke. It's quite an old fashioned record. And I think that the singing, this would have never happened unless I had picked up singing.
That's awesome, man. So that's really cool.
Yeah. It made me reevaluate myself as an artist and reevaluate what I wanted to express. And what I want to express has got to have words and a voice. That's what I've learned. Yeah.
That's great, man. That's a really cool thing to have a breakthrough.
I basically
like
used all these session recordings just to get some practical skills in singing.
Hmm.
That's why I'm singing on all of them or on a lot of them.
That's wonderful,
just
man.
My training, my public training.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in East Germany.
In East Germany. What was your childhood like growing up?
What's that? Okay. In GDR.
Yeah.
So I'm born in 85. So I had 5 years of East German dictatorship growing up. I've experienced that. Yeah.
How did that, that's a question I want to ask. How did that, did anything about that impact you or make a mark on you versus post that? What was it? To the extent you're comfortable.
I think there's a few things that stuck with me. First of all, it was probably the most horrendous country to live in Europe at that time, because there was no freedom of speech. There was no freedom of travel, no freedom of press. It was a police state where people were spying on each other. My father could later on look into his files and see that some of his friends were spying on him and telling the police. Like there's files, there's records that state when he met my mother, his future wife.
Holy crap.
Yeah. That's what that was. Society was like. And if you were not part of the system, if you were not part of the party and the political system, you wouldn't get a chance to study in the same way. You wouldn't get the same perks. It was a really messed up society. And however, what the effect that had is that so I grew up in a tiny village. People were much tighter back then because that they only had each other to rely on.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't any wealth. There wasn't a lot of materialistic goods. And this is totally hypocritical because I'm saying this being surrounded by guitars, but I really, for the longest time, learned to live with very little. And my materialistic needs are very low. And I'm my financial needs are very low. I think I want to earn just enough money to have a healthy, decent life, and that I can express myself, that I get time to express myself. And anything beyond that, I'm not too interested in. I'd rather spend, for example, when I was in my late student years, or the few years after being a student, I decided to make a record instead of instructional products. And I decided to invest the little money I had into making art as opposed to earning money from making instructional products.
Sure.
And I think those decisions were informed by having that kind of very modest lifestyle in the early years.
Yeah. Wow. First of all, thank you. That's really interesting. I don't get to hear that viewpoint very often. Do you think also the value of being able to express yourself freely is probably much greater to you than like me or somebody that has not had that experience?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that I get to travel the world playing music, that is a privilege that my father did not have.
Yeah.
Or like for him to acquire records from the West, say Dark Side of the Moon, that had to be done illegally.
Yeah. Black market.
To be consumed secretly. That's,
yeah.
And that puts a whole different value on that type of thing. I think. And he still has those records, right? He still has all the old Genesis records and that stuff. And that just means so much. And it's, man, people from the Spotify age, they have no idea. They just have no idea.
It's interesting. Do you happen to know a guitarist? I think he's in Hungary or Romania, named A.G. Weinberger.
No, I haven't heard of him.
He's a blues guitarist, and he grew up – I had him here on the show. He grew up in one of those countries was communist, okay? And it's interesting what he said. He in a sense, misses some of that because of the unity of the people. Yeah,
that's what I said earlier.
People
were much tighter. Society was knitted much more tightly. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was interesting. And I have no frame of reference on either of these things, you know, because I've always grown up here. So
yeah, of course. And in West Germany was the polar opposite of that.
Yeah.
It was just the same country divided into two, and they couldn't have been any more different from another. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Yeah, we sometimes take all these things for granted, but man, people have been suffering to get us where we are.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, because he would say same thing. He used to get things on the black market. He used to get music, magazines, condoms. He'd have to get on the black market. I mean, he was really funny. He told all these coffee, you know, and it was just.
But I think that grind shapes you as a person.
Oh, yeah.
But to be fair, I didn't have any of that grind because by the time I was five, the wall opened up. The Berlin wall opened. I was moving to. But some of this, I obviously, my parents passed some of these.
Yeah, of course.
Ideologies on to me. It's the same. Like when I met Steve Morse, he said to me, "Oh, you know, you young people, I feel like such a beginner next to you and that kind of thing." Because there is a technical race happening in the guitar community right now, right?
Yes.
And he's like, he has problems with his hands, and he feels kind of inadequate. And I was like, and nowadays you can just download some products or slow things down in the computer. And I said to him, you built your own guitar and you put these things together, and that grind made you the legend you are. Anybody can just shred in their bedroom, but
yeah, yeah. Oh, I agree with you.
Is a legend for what he went through to get where he is now.
Totally. I agree with you 100%. Yeah. It's a different, I think, I agree with you 100%. And thanks for sharing that. That was really interesting about that growing up in the communist side of things. When did you know you wanted to be a musician? Because this has been a pretty long pursuit of yours.
I think it was a lack of options, really. You get to the last 2 years of high school and you just need to something. That's just the only thing that really tickled me was music. It was the only thing I was interested in. So for a lack of options, that's what I decided to go with. And in the last 2 years of high school, I made a commitment that I'm going to be studying music because, you know, I also wanted to calm my parents down. So if I'm going to do music, at least get a degree in it.
Were they, they were supportive, I'm assuming?
Oh yeah. Actually.
Yeah. Sounds like they're really supportive.
But from that moment, I started neglecting school completely. So my grades were suffering greatly from that. And I think we really got to rethink our school systems a little bit.
I agree with you.
Because a lot of people, even up to when they start studying, they don't know what they want to do with their lives. And they keep changing degrees all the time and meandering about. I knew at age 16, I wanted to become a musician, and school and also social services that I had to do, mm-hmm. I mean, they hindered me from that. They took away the time that I could have used to become a better musician.
Yes. Yeah.
When I knew what I was going to be doing. Instead, the high school system was actually trying to push that down because I was being a troublemaker. You know, I never had my books with me. I never had my homework done. I had shit grades.
Yeah.
And they kept pushing me. They kept pushing against me.
Yeah.
When all I really, all, the only difference was that I already knew what I was going to do with my life.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally get it. I agree with you there. Like my younger son is 28. He went back to school later in life and he's going to be a physical therapist, and he's mm-hmm. got to study. He's in college and some of the stuff he's got to study is like, you know, he's studying like a calculus and he's like, Dad, why did, and I'm like, I have no idea. You'll never use this. It's completely irrelevant to anything you're going to do. And it's a waste of your time. So I agree with you. And
at least it's got to be a way that schools support when you have a talent,
yes,
and you have a will to pursue that talent. There's got to be a way for the school system to encourage that instead of pushing back.
There's a book I read a long time ago, I think by a guy, I can't think of the name of the book, Eric Hoffer or Hofer. Mm-hmm. And he, I think in the book he said something like, school is designed to teach you to obey, not absolutely necessarily to learn. And I agree with that 100%.
Those were from, in Germany, the school system was created in the times of Bismarck, when basically the school was supposed to put out an obedient population.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And yeah, it just doesn't apply anymore, that type of thing. Yeah.
Well, especially nowadays, there's, unless you have my son's going to be a physical therapist, or you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer, self-study almost anything because of the internet now. There's no reason to.
Although not everybody has the desire to do that, which is fair.
Yeah, totally.
Self-study, and not everybody thrives in a self-study environment. So did my camera just go?
Yeah, you're fine now.
Not everybody thrives in that environment. Like I'm with so many things, I'm middle of the road. I have formal training, but I have a ton of self-study as well. So for me, to have my self-studies backed up with formal training is what really helped me.
That's what gives, low points. Tell me some of the low points or dark periods you've had to deal with in life, and how'd you get through them?
Wow. Okay.
That's a very non-German interview question, right?
why is that? I'm interested in. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think my perception is, in most European countries in general, they're not as they wouldn't get as deep. And in the English speaking countries as well, like I've had tons of guys from England on this show, and it tends to be a little more formalized in interviews than okay, at least on my show anyway.
Yeah. Well,
I could be, maybe I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. I need to.
I'm not getting any interview requests from Germany. It's kind of.
Well, you should be.
People in your own country don't care about you as much. Low points. So I would say big low point. I touched on that earlier a little bit. A big low phase for me was when I got out of college, and the comfort of having a regular schedule dissipated. It went away completely from one day to the next.
Yeah.
Now you're on your own. Now you got to earn money and make a living. And I just fell into a huge depression where I just was playing video games all day and not leave the bed because I didn't see light at the end of the tunnel. I thought, so I'm going to be doing gigs on the weekends now and teaching during the week, people who don't want to learn. And I got really depressed about that. And I struggled financially for a very, very long time. And yeah, I mean, my personal relationship suffered from that. And yeah, that was tough. And I don't think I was a very pleasant human being to be around, because I was having such a lack of orientation. So that was low point number one, I would say. Low point number two, I was going through last year and still kind of going through. Not the answer you think it is, not COVID related. Actually, I had a noise trauma, a headphone accident. There was a loud noise that blasted through my headphones, and I've picked up a pretty severe tinnitus ever since.
Holy, that is, and my wife has that. It's horrible.
I've had a tinnitus for 7 years already, but this one takes it to a whole new level. And I had to learn to adapt to that. And I'm coming to grips with it now, but I'm kind of traumatized from it. So I've developed kind of a real sensitivity to noises. Like when I'm walking down the street and a car is honking, I get really, I get kind of PTSD.
Yeah.
So I have to learn to deal with that a little better. I am now. So the first few months when I didn't know how this thing behaves. So for example, what happens, you go to sleep. You try to ignore it when falling asleep, and you wake up the next morning, especially if you're woken up by the phone or something like that, your nervous system is on full alert and the ears are going crazy. And I thought when the first time that, or the first few times that happened, I thought, is this going to be permanent now?
Yeah.
Is this what it's going to be like? And of course it calms itself down throughout the day, but yeah, learning to adapt to that was a real, real struggle. Yeah. And still is, but I'm getting better at it, but it still is tough at times.
Couple of things. First, thank you for sharing. That was really cool and interesting.
It's good, therapeutic for me to talk about it.
Oh, good, man. There you go. Yeah. Couple of things. Have you seen Sound of Metal?
No.
If you get a chance, watch that movie. It's phenomenal. It's a little slow moving, but it's about a guy who's a heavy metal drummer, mm-hmm. and he goes deaf. And he does an amazing, I mean, just like the portrayal of like, what's the worst thing that could happen to a musician, right? He's deaf and he does it good. Also, Paul is yeah. openly discussed about his hearing issues. You know,
he actually, we had to adapt for him quite a bit, our studio setup. So usually we don't crank amps because we want to have a clean recording of the drums. So we use something like the Universal Audio Aux that
sure.
takes an amplifier output and puts it to a line level so we can record with in-ears. Paul couldn't use in-ears, so we had a big monitor box in front of him that the vocals and my guitar and the bass and the keyboards were on, and he had his amp cranked and we had to shield the drums, but he had to be next to the drums because he plays the way he locks in, he cannot hear a hi-hat. He locks in by feeling the resonance of the bass drum and the snare drum through the floor.
Yeah.
He has to be next to the drum kit. And, you know, for example, our Superstition cover, he does all these fills in between the vocals, but he cannot really hear any vocals. So what he does, he'll stare at you and he'll look at your lips when you stop singing. That's when he will
chime in. Wow, interesting. Yeah, he talked quite extensively about it. It's been a hell of an adjustment.
It's an impressive, I mean, it's unbelievable how he does it, how he copes with it. He's such a positively spirited person. And also as a musician, how he deals with that, because he nowadays, as far as I'm concerned, plays better than ever.
Yeah, he's playing great. He sounds amazing. How did you, when you had that issue, when you first got out of college and you were feeling down, how did you push yourself out of that?
It took me a long time. Yeah. I'd be lying if I said one day I just collected myself. it was an ongoing process over years.
Yeah.
And it got better when people finally started taking note of some of the things I was doing. And I was actually thinking, oh, there's actually somebody out there who cares.
Yeah.
And then I thought to myself, I owe it to myself, the people around me, and the people who like what I do to become better.
Yeah. Well, good for you. Thank you for sharing that, man. That was really cool of you. Any, if you had to go back and give your younger self advice, is there any advice you would have told yourself that would have made life easier for you? Business, personal, whatever.
Yeah, don't waste so much time. Make use of your time. Don't procrastinate so much. Acquire your skills early on because you're not going to have time later, but nobody believes that when they're young.
Yeah, isn't that the funny thing?
Right?
It's like telling somebody to invest.
Don't they say... youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah, it's an expression.
And that's so true. That's so true. Yeah, like I would have loved I would have definitely picked up voice and piano earlier if I had the chance, and grinded much harder on guitar.
Yeah, well, I think you've grinded pretty hard on guitar, man.
Yeah, but later on, I was a late bloomer with the guitar as well. So I was not particularly talented. I was not like a standout musician at college by any means. Or something like that.
You really committed, though. You took a lot of education, man. I give you credit for that. Yeah. That was really
big. I went to the conservatory, to college, and self-studies. And I'm taking vocal lessons up, even nowadays.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you happen to know a guy? I had another guy from Germany on the show, a guy in West Germany, Nick von Delft.
No.
He plays
sounds Dutch.
Yeah, he's lives in Germany, though. He's actually German, but he's obviously von Delft, he's probably Dutch. He plays kind of like in a stoner rock band. Just thought you might know. You mentioned that the style of music you play is changing, and you talked about it earlier. Is the basis for that your ability now to sing and express yourself in a different way?
Yes. I think I now get to do the music that I always wanted to make. The thing is, with my first record, that record is kind of all over the place style wise, and I think that record is almost like a portfolio. Here's what I can do on the guitar. Have a listen. But it was not entirely in the name of artistic expression. I think I was still learning my craft at the time when I did that record, and I think for that it is fair. I learned to mix doing that record. Even though the mixes were in, but And I learned to dabble in different sizes. It's all, I see it as part, as a stepping stone to where I am now. It's, and yeah. as such, I can appreciate it. But as an artistic statement, I stand behind the upcoming record, but not so much behind the first.
I get it. Yeah. I think anytime you look back at stuff you've done, it's easy to, you know, you're further ahead and it's like, eh, you know.
Yeah, God knows in 10 years, I might say this thing about the record. You'll never know.
You're 100% right. You might. All right, let's talk about gear for just a few minutes. Yes. I know you have a new signature model.
Looming in the background.
There you go, man. Talk about it. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars would round out your top three?
It'll be this.
Okay.
Ibanez 7. I don't think they're even available publicly yet. I've seen like a few floating around, but it's rare. Because obviously COVID has struck the music instrument industry really hard too. So the deliveries are going to go out a little bit slowly over the upcoming months, depending on where you are.
Sure.
This is the 7-string version of the MM1, which has been my main guitar for the last 3 years. It's essentially the very same guitar with an extra string on it, but with extremely well-designed ergonomics, such as the neck profile, the string spacing, and all of that has been fine-tuned to be, it's almost, you wouldn't know you're playing a 7-string. Like, I'm primarily a 6-string player, and this guitar feels like a 6-string with extra range.
What is that, like a roasted maple neck?
They call it S-Tech. And it's basically, it's done by, I think these necks are actually done by a company that does outside furniture.
That's interesting.
They do that process to where they suck all the moisture out of the neck. And it's actually a more elaborate process than most other companies do. There's a bunch of extra steps to it. And yeah, these necks are absolutely stable. I've toured with my MM1 for like 2 years and went from Finland to Southeast Asia.
Wow.
I've set up that guitar once when I got it and then never again.
Wow. And that's a big change of humidity there, of moisture. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
What pickups in there?
Yeah. Seymour Duncan Hyperion, essentially the 7-string version of the 6-string pickups, only available in this guitar. So they're tailor made to this guitar. You cannot get them as aftermarket pickups. Mm. And it's got one of the key features is also that you have a vintage tremolo instead of a double locking tremolo, which is what most of these types of guitars have. So if you're like me and you're really not a fan of double locking tremolos, this is one of the very, very few guitars that has that kind of thing. And also one main difference from the mainline AZ models is this is the only one with a mahogany body and a flame maple top.
Very cool.
So it's a different sound, different aesthetic and a different sound from the rest of the series. You would think that what is your association with mahogany sound wise?
You know what? I'm not smart enough to go to relate wood to sound.
Well, Les Pauls usually are made out of mahogany. So you,
warm.
Les Pauls are such dark sounding guitars, warm sounding guitars. You associate that. But if you, I do have an Alder 7-string here, same model, but Alder.
Right.
The mahogany sounds brighter, more balanced.
Interesting.
It sounds a bit flatter spectrum wise. So that makes the guitar just really versatile because it's not shoehorned towards any frequency range. It's just really.
What do you flexible. Like? What do you like best about it?
As I said earlier, that I have that extended range, but it doesn't feel like I have to adjust anything.
Very cool.
That I feel like I have to adjust my hand position or my playing style. In fact, that little extra meat on the neck, I really enjoy that. So I'll be even playing this 7-string when I don't need that 7th string. I'm actually, I was thinking to myself, how am I going to use the 7-string? The obvious way is to play heavy riffs on the low strings, right?
Right.
But I'm currently exploring other avenues, such as like being able to play bass lines while I comp another musician or stuff like that. So that is something I'm dabbling in. And also I want to use this guitar like a 5-string bass. You know, a lot of people when they see somebody play a 7-string guitar, they go and they the player doesn't chuck away in the low string all the time. It's like, why do you even have a 7-string? You're not playing that low string. But nobody says that to a bass player, right? When they
play
like a 4-string instrument, but occasionally play a low note. I kind of want to treat it like that.
Okay.
Maybe I'll not use the low string at all. Maybe I'll use it all the time during a song, or maybe I'll use it for one or two notes in a song to lift a certain moment up.
I'm smelling new product. This would be a great, no, seriously, the seven string, that would be a great product down the road, because I think a lot of people are moving.
Seven strings are very popular among metal guitar players.
Yes.
But this guitar actually offers non-metal sounds plus the extended range.
Right. That's what I'm saying. And you're the kind of guy, now that I've gotten to know you a little bit, you'll figure out how to leverage each of those in different genres that you're doing. So,
yes. And I might use it very sparsely. I'm just because I have that seven string. It's like Simon Phillips. You've interviewed Simon Phillips, right?
I did.
Because he has all those toms, doesn't fit them in every song. Sometimes when he plays more jazzy stuff, he treats it like a three-piece kit.
Yes. Yeah, he's a phenomenal drummer. That was a good interview. That was a real good interview.
That was amazing. Yeah, I love that interview. I've watched it start to finish.
Thank you. Yeah. What else? Okay, so what's number two and number three for you guitar wise?
Let's see. I don't have them all at display at the moment, but I really like.
I like the black walls there, man. That's kind of cool.
This one, I like a lot.
Okay, what is that?
That's kind of a.
Like a Tele and a Jazzmaster.
I just don't like that when I think what we call it. Let's call it a two single coil, single cutaway guitar. But this one is like the polar opposite of my seven string. This is for the traditional sounds.
Sure.
I've played the little wing cover on this one, and has a beautiful creamy sound of the neck pickup and a really nice aggressive bite in the front pickup. So that is one that I love. I also really enjoy this one. There you go. This one is an RGD. This one has a slightly extended scale.
Yeah, that's
so it's good for tuning down. I actually have it at standard tuning, and I enjoy the extended scale because it gives you a little more room for error.
Holy shit, your fingers are really large. I didn't realize that.
No. My fingers are tiny, tiny.
But when you just stretched, I was like, holy crap. Then you,
Yeah, my fingers are tiny. They're as small as my girlfriend's. I've never, honestly, never met a male guitar player with smaller hands than me.
Wow. Yeah, but you just stretched there. You're.
That was not intentional.
Yeah. Holy shit! You covered about 12 frets on that stretch. That was pretty impressive.
So this one has an Evertune bridge. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Not specifically, no.
So essentially, what this is, you know how a tremolo has springs in the back.
Yes.
That balance out the string tension, and this one has a dedicated spring for every string, and you set the tension once by dialing it down here. And then that guitar will stay in tune for the rest of the string's life.
Oh, that's really cool. So you could beat the crap out of that and it's fine.
Absolutely. What you can do, you can also tighten it up here with the tuners so the string doesn't wobble. So you can, this is especially great for playing rhythm guitar in the studio. You can smash the low E string. You know how oftentimes it'll go wow.
Sure.
When you do that, not with this guitar.
That's
so cool. That's the Evertune bridge.
I like those pickups, man. They look great.
Yeah, those are actually, I exchanged those. Those are aftermarket Seymour Duncan pickups.
Is that where you primarily use Duncans?
Yeah. I'm going Duncan exclusively now. I've been super happy with the Hyperions in my signature guitar. And so I wanted to make that relationship more official. It hasn't been announced yet, but I mean, it's...
Sure.
We're going to do an official announcement, but I've been working with Seymour Duncan for a couple of months now, and we're going to make things more official.
Good, man. Congratulations. And congratulations on that. You're getting your second guitar. That's a pretty big thing, man.
Yeah, man. I said this is like for – it's very European comparison. It's like winning the Champions League. Getting a second signature guitar is like winning the Champions League twice in a row.
Well, congratulations. Hey, have you ever sold a guitar that you wish you can get back?
Yes. Oh, there have been a few, yeah. That harkens back to my student days when I could only afford to have one instrument, right? And I had to sell good guitars for very low prices. Yeah. So there has been an Ibanez RG550 EX, a limited run where there was only a couple in Germany at the time. It was a blue guitar with a plexiglass pickguard, and I modded it beyond belief. I changed the tuners. I plecked the frets. I had the frets plecked. I changed the pickups. I changed so many things about that guitar. And then I eventually sold it because I needed a couple bucks. That was so stupid. And I also had a heavily modded Charvel Strat.
I like those, man. They sound great. Yes.
It looks like a full-on Strat. It had a maple. It was in my very first YouTube video. If you scroll all the way down, you see that guitar. And it had a maple neck, one-piece maple neck, and a black body. It was also heavily modified. And yeah, that was a really nice guitar. It just, you know, sometimes you get those urges as a guitar player. That guitar really didn't stay in tune very well,
right,
because of how the strings came off the nut into the headstock.
Okay.
It just wouldn't stay in tune. And I just get so mad at that I just sold it.
You know what? That's a good reason to get rid of a guitar. I can't stand when something doesn't stay. It's just like,
well, then you got to check out those Evertune bridges, man.
Yeah.
Because they'll never go out of tune.
Do you do all the mods yourself, or do you hire someone? No.
No. My father used to do them for me. He's a crafty guy.
Oh, that's cool.
And nowadays I have somebody here in town who I bring a guitar to like every week. Dude, here's a new one. Do this. I have no talent when it comes to mechanical things.
Well, it's a lot of work too. If you're not like inclined, it's like fixing your roof or something like that. It's not something that you can.
This place, I have to have mechanics here all the time to fix stuff for me because I can't do it myself. I do not have that talent or the urge to become good at it. I just don't.
Yeah. If you like it, it's great. If you don't, it's misery, man.
Yeah.
I agree.
I'm not a crafty guy by any means. Yeah. My girlfriend is better at that stuff than me.
Well, hang on to her.
So yeah. she changes strings much faster than I do. So that's
hey, this is a tough one. Give me your top three Desert Island discs. No particular order, but just for right now. Like all this right. can change in 10 minutes or.
Okay. Pink Floyd, The Wall.
Yeah.
Pat Metheny, Letter from Home. And I would say Dream Theater, Images and Words.
It's funny.
Those I wouldn't want to live without.
It's funny. For some reason, I remember Mark Lethierry mentioned his top three was a Pat Metheny record too. Mm-hmm. Funny enough. Yeah. All righty. Are you good with balancing your time? Like, between work and fun?
No. Yeah. I'm way too focused on work.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's just sometimes really need my girlfriend to drag me back into life and focus me.
Yeah. It's hard.
Especially become off balance in this whole pandemic mess.
Oh God. Yeah. Because at least you have something to hang on to that's consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gotta be honest. I have not been bored for a minute.
Yeah. No, I haven't either.
As long as I have, this setup around me and I can create, I'll be a happy, happy guy.
Yeah,
but of course that takes the private life off center and there's some social needs that are not being met. And
yeah. Yeah. It's hard to do in the pandemic, man, especially over there. I know you guys are really locked down. All right. What makes you happy?
Makes me happy. Good food.
What do you like to eat, man?
All kinds of things. You have this way. We have this great thing we're doing ever since the pandemic started. It's called HelloFresh. And it's basically, it's a company that brings in fresh ingredients from local suppliers. So if there's meat, it'll be from a local farmer. And they bring that in and they give you recipes. So we get 5 recipes per week and we get the exact amount of ingredients we need. So if one recipe requires one tooth of garlic, you only get that one thing. Nothing is left at the end of the day. You get a freshly cooked different meal every day. So that stuff I've been digging.
That's cool.
It's absolutely incredible. And it has improved my diet a ton. that's my favorite. Other than that, I'm really an addict or a sucker for a good kebab.
A good kebab. There you go, man.
Yeah.
It's funny, they have some stuff, HelloFresh, something like it over here. And my older son, who's just a few years younger than you, does the same thing with his girlfriend. They order it all the time.
People who can't cook for themselves or have no idea how to do it. It's still not easy to do, but it's almost idiot-proof.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
tastes insanely good. It tastes better than most restaurants.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Very cool. So what else makes you happy? Good food. What else?
Good food. Time for myself, an appropriate amount of time for myself to just reflect. That is something that I found is very important to me.
Man, it's really important. If you just sit and think about something, just to take the time, 10 minutes even, it really makes a huge difference as opposed to...
I'm a bit weird to that. So when if I'm among people for too long a time, it sucks my energy out of me. I just need a balance. So even if there's a huge party or so, every once in a while, I'll just go to the bathroom, sit there for 2 minutes. Let's just take a breath. And then
by nature, you tend to be shy?
No, okay. Not shy, but an introvert.
Introvert. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. I'm introverted, but not shy. Yeah. So we're having no problem talking to each other. So I'm not shy by any means, but
no.
I thrive when I'm among people I know. And when I'm surrounded by strangers, I'm still outgoing, but it takes me a lot of energy.
Yeah. So, I get that. I have friends.
For example,
like that.
being on tour and meeting people after the show, and getting introduced to a ton of strangers, and I want to leave a good impression. I want to be friendly, and I want to be polite, and I want to be whatever they want in terms of autographs or photos. I want to take all the time that is necessary to make people happy. But at the same time, that costs me a lot of energy. There's some people who are so extroverted that they absolutely thrive in that scenario, and they get their energy from that. For me, that takes me energy, and at the end of a day such as that, when I drop dead in my hotel room.
I understand that. I've spoken to so many people like that. Yeah, it's I get that, man. And I give you credit for, in spite of that, still doing it, which is really cool.
No, it's fantastic. I mean, the what you get back, the reactions you get back, it takes so little when you're in that scenario. It takes so little for you to make somebody else happy.
Yeah.
You have to do it.
Yeah.
No brainer. I would expect the same from my heroes.
Sure, sure. Has that ever happened to you where you don't have to name names? Where you
no
like wanted to connect with someone and they were like, you know, later, like they just
that has happened.
Yeah, that's always disappointing.
You know, musicians are just like regular people. You have X amount of people who just aren't particularly nice.
Yeah.
Then you have some people who are incredible. I find that the average to be very much. As with non-musicians.
Yeah, I would agree with you there.
With that said, all the folks that I've worked with, especially in the last few years that we got into the studio, top-notch people.
Yeah. No, I've been fortunate the same. I think people are the same, but for whatever reason, I think since most of the people I get introduced to come from other people I met, it tends to be, you know, birds of a feather flock together. So it tends to, you know, be pretty cool people. All right. This is a tough question, man. What do you like most about yourself?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Well, that is a tough one. What do I like most about myself? Huh. I don't see myself that way. I like that. Well, guess if I had to choose something, and I'm not comfortable choosing, but if I had to choose something, it's that I'm a doer.
Sure.
And not a talker. I think I'm pretty genuine. Like when you ask me for what my struggles are, I find a lot of artists these days when they do these kind of live streams or interviews or that type of thing, that they sugarcoat their answers.
Sometimes, yeah.
And I'm not into that stuff. Like the other day I did a live stream at the Enderton's
channel. Oh yeah.
And I was in the middle of moving, and I was looking absolutely horrendous, and I was totally exhausted. Like 10 PM after move day. And I was totally smashed. And I was just, that was the most candid interview I've ever given.
That's so funny.
It was completely honest. I'm not a very vain person. I'm just the way I am. I guess that's the thing that's a positive.
Yeah, trait. All those things are good, man. What would your girlfriend say she likes most about you?
Oh God! Oh God! Oh God! What does she say? I guess the same thing. I think I picked, you know what? She said that to me after that Anderton's live stream that she watched. And she said that to me. And I think that's why I gave it as an answer subconsciously.
Oh, cool. That's good.
She would appreciate that. And I'm a pretty funny guy if I have to be. So I can make her laugh and entertain her.
That's important.
I can be pretty darn silly. You know, I look so serious when I play music, but outside of music, I'm just the silliest dude.
That's awesome. Yeah. Who's had the biggest influence on your life, both musically and then also personally?
Well, personally, it's got to be my father, a person who's been there from the start and is still around. So yeah, that's definitely as far as I see so many reflections of myself from him.
From your dad, yeah.
From my father, that's for sure, yeah. So as far as personal life goes, it's got to be my father. And yeah, musically, yeah, Steve Morris is huge. John Petrucci is huge. Pat Metheny. A lot of non-guitar players. Simon Phillips is a big influence of mine as far as sound aesthetics and groove. Chick Corea as far as composition. I get inspired by a lot of guys like, you wouldn't believe, like Michael Brecker is a big influence of mine.
Sure.
His attitude with which he solos, his approach to making music. I love piano players such as Oscar Peterson, who's so fiery and virtuosic. That has always impressed me a lot.
Just listening to Night Train yesterday by Oscar Peterson. Yeah, it's a good record.
Yeah, the I love his time feel. I love how he carries the music, especially when he plays just by himself, how he carries the music. Art Tatum is in that same vein, absolutely phenomenal. I also love a lot of romantic classical composers. I'm a big Chopin fan. That musical aesthetic, Phil Collins, Peter Gabriel, Queen, Pink Floyd, all the good 70s and 80s stuff is really
right on, man.
Stuff, yeah.
It's funny when you said about your dad that you see a lot of your traits. As a parent, he's smiling too. Because we do that with our kids. Like, you know, this one does this. Oh, it's just like me. And it's just kind of funny to see, you know, especially if you have a child that does equal of both of you. It's just really funny to see how that all works out.
I look like more like my mother.
Uh-huh.
And I don't look like my father at all. But personality-wise, my mother was very different from myself.
Right.
I'm a pretty chaotic guy by nature, and she was very organized.
Okay.
I'm an artsy-fartsy guy, and she was very, very strict, very organized, very ordered. And that is not me.
That's funny. So you look like your mom, but your traits, personality, you follow suit of your dad more.
Yeah. There's one major difference between me and my father, and my father is a jack-of-all-trades.
Gotcha.
So he can fix the light bulb. He can fix the washing machine. He can also build a computer, but he can also play a little guitar, and he knows a ton about culture. He knows about opera, about theater, about history, about law. He knows a bit about everything. And he's a jack of all trades. Yeah. And I'm a one trick pony.
Yeah. You're a master of one.
Yeah. I have a problem with the word master, but yeah, I'm focused. My focus of what I'm good is much more narrow.
Yeah, I get that, man. I get that. You mentioned you play, you're a gamer. Any other hobbies or interests outside of music?
I follow football. Not the American football.
I know, soccer.
Yes, soccer. Soccer, that's the one I'm following. Yeah,
yeah, I get it.
So yeah, I'm a big fan of that. Yeah, other than that, gaming, like to hang out with my folks. I have very, very simple needs. I think I just need a space to be creative. I need to be surrounded by people that I love. And the occasional video game, bit of football, good food. And I'm a happy, happy dude.
And yeah, HelloFresh. Favorite place you've traveled? You've been all over the world.
Oh, wow. Home.
Really?
I'll say home.
Interesting.
Bar none. And I really love to travel and get my mind blown. And the more my mind is blown, the happier I am when I get back. For example, I've been to a lot of Asian countries, like 1.5 years ago, to like 10 different Asian countries. I was in Hong Kong, for example, and Hong Kong is just like the movie Blade Runner come to life.
Wow.
It's truly, truly mind blowing. But I could not see myself living in a place like that, as mind blowing as it is. Same with New York City. I'd like to get my mind blown. I love to take it all in. And then when I get home and have all this space around me, that's what I really like.
Do you still live in a small town?
No, like 500,000 people. So mid-sized.
Okay. Yeah. So mid-sized.
It's just about the right amount of stuff around me and with the right amount of space. I find that seems to be what's working.
Sure.
What's working for me. And yeah, but I've seen some incredible places, even stuff that most people wouldn't maybe suspect. Like, for example, I think Moscow is very beautiful.
Sure.
Has some mind-blowing sights. There's great places all over the world. I mean, and most importantly, gracious people.
Yeah, totally, man. Two more questions. And thank you very much for being so cool and for being so open. I really appreciate it. Toughest decision you had to make or most difficult thing you had to do?
My girlfriend's walking outside. I wish I could ask her. She probably knows. Toughest decision I had to make. I wouldn't know. There hasn't been the one decision. There's been tough decisions all along my path. Do I make an album? Do I earn money?
Yeah.
It's a tough decision.
Yeah.
Do I stay independent or do I make a deal with Ivanus? Ivanus, and it was the best decision I've made as far as business goes.
Great.
There's all these kind of challenges along your way. I've had a few surgeries because I had chronic sinusitis. Those things are tough decisions to make. Yeah. Do I go under the knife? Is it worth it?
Yeah.
So I haven't had the one tough decision to make in life yet.
Good. I hope you don't.
That hasn't occurred yet.
Germany's healthcare system is, how does that work? Is it like socialized medicine?
You pay into a pot and you get money out of the pot if you need it.
Okay.
So the more you earn, the more you pay into the pot.
Okay.
And of course I'm paying quite a bit of money, quite a percentage. Everybody does.
Yeah.
Into the pot. But then when it comes to stuff like having a sinusitis surgery, it literally cost me $20.
Wow. That's pretty cool. See, over here you pay it's like if you might pay $1,500 a month for insurance. And then you have a $10,000 deductible on top of that.
My girlfriend is a foreigner, and she has a smaller time private insurance here. And even going to the doctor to get your blood checked, and suddenly you're paying $150 for that. And we're just so used to that being like the norm. Whenever you feel like it, you go and you get that for quote unquote free. It's not free.
What, $20? Yeah.
In another way.
For it. Yeah. Interesting.
But it's a system where people who are stronger than you support you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's an idea that I really like. And also, like, you know, it sucks to pay X amount of money every month, but the more money I make, I'm actually happy to give some of that to support the health of people who honestly, if I'm struggling, I expect that kind of help too.
Sure.
And I'm happy that I can rely on that. Yeah.
Yeah. As our healthcare system's horrible, man. It's really bad.
I don't want to open a can of worms here.
No. I'm just saying, I wish it was different for everybody, man. It's like, you know, this is 2021 and like people don't
health get... shouldn't be a privilege for the rich. That's a very politically vocal person, but I think we can all, if we're kind of sensible, we should agree that health is not a privilege for rich people.
Totally. Yeah, man. People get sick and they need to be healthy. I agree with you there, man. Last question. What is the biggest change in your personality been over, say, the last 5 years? And how much of that has been intentional and how much is just a natural process of aging or in life?
I think it's mostly become for the better. I've become, as I've mentioned, I'm a very chaotic person. I've become more organized, more streamlined, become more disciplined. I have a better work ethic. And thanks to my girlfriend, I've become a bit more orderly. Because I'm a mess if I'm not under constraint. I'll just leave stuff everywhere. So, by the way, this room I just moved. This is still a work in progress. This is going to be much nicer once it's finished.
It looks pretty organized. It looks pretty good.
Yeah, I strategic camera placement. So, yeah, I think it's gotten better. I've become more of a doer than a talker, I think. That's hopefully something that, but on the contrary, I've become more of a hermit at the same time. That is something I need to work on.
Yeah.
Become more of a hermit, especially in the last year.
It's interesting. I'm 21 years older than you. And, I always used to read these things about how, friendships are really like actually a help your physical health. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing that as I'm getting older now that I go out of my way to have more relationships and make the phone call and, you know, because
I need to get better at.
Yeah. It's rewarding.
And now I'm at the age where my friends are getting kids. So they're having babies and it's getting tougher to keep up.
It is. Last quick question for you. Is that an Ibanez AS guitar over there on your left?
Right there, it's an AS-153.
Yeah, I like those.
It's a slightly lower tier. It's not the 200. It's the slightly lower tier. I wouldn't want to own a 200 because I'm not playing that guitar too often because I'm playing solid bodies. So I would feel bad owning full-blown.
No, I get it, man. Hey, let me tell people where they could find you. First of all, thank you again so much, man. I really appreciate your time. It was great talking with
you. Thanks for having me. Oh, this has been cathartic.
This has been what?
This has been cathartic.
Oh, good, man. I'm happy for you. That's awesome. Okay. You got your signature guitar from Ibanez. Do you think that'll be rolled out?
Over the upcoming months. I've seen some of them pop up here and there. Just got to keep checking back. For the US, Sweetwater is listing them already, but with an uncertain delivery date. So, yeah. Toman is listing it in Europe. All the local dealers in Germany, as far as Germany goes, all the local dealers who work with Ibanez will have it once it's there. If right now there's a bit of shortage of supplies and
it's for everything,
they'll get it sorted. They'll get it. So they're a fantastic company, top notch customer service too. And yeah, if you buy one, you'll be in good hands.
Very cool. Okay, upcoming record. You haven't talked about that.
I won't make any promises when it's coming out. When it's finished, I can give you the status. All the music is written. All the drums are recorded. All the basses are recorded. All the guitars are recorded.
Oh, wow.
90% of the keyboards are recorded. 80% of the vocals are recorded and lyrics are written. I have one more complete tune to write lyrics for and record the vocals. And I'm also mixing the record. The record is also mixed. I literally just got to replace the new lyrics. And that'll be it. But then that's not where it ends, right? Then I got to take care of artwork, got to make music videos. I got to change my website to have like an identity that resembles the record. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work that'll come from that point where it's truly finished. So I'll be happy to release it. And hopefully, don't quote me on that, 3 to 4 months.
Great, man. Is there is there a title if you want to share it? Or if not, that's cool.
I don't have a title yet.
Okay.
I do not have a title yet because not all the lyrics are written. And I want to reserve that. I do have one word that I want to call that I could see myself calling the record. It's called But that may not be the final.
Yeah, I think that's smart. Yeah, just that's a good one. And also, you got a bunch of stuff on jtcguitar.com. You want to talk about any of that in particular?
Yeah, so most of my online instructional products can be found at jtcguitar.com. My best-selling product would be my Improv Masterclass. That has been an ongoing product. I'm currently writing a new product for JTC. I'm in the early stages, so no promise. I hope to have it out in the next few months as well. I can't speak about the topic yet because I might still decide on doing something else, but I have something that I think people will be really interested in. So keep an eye out for that. And also, there's my website, martinmillerguitar.com. All the products are linked there. You can access it from there as well, and that'll lead you to those
sources. Right on, man. That's great. Yeah. JTCguitar.com and martinmillerguitar.com. All right. Any final words of wisdom?
Keep your heads up, guys. Stay strong. And we'll soon be able to hug each other and see each other on the road.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Thank you for everything, man. I really appreciate your time. Yeah. It was great talking. Thanks, great getting to know you. Oh, my pleasure, man. Yeah. Hang on one sec. Let me wrap this up. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Martin Miller. Again, look out for him at JTC. All his products, and there are many. He's pretty prolific. JTCguitar.com and also martinmillerguitar.com. His new Ibanez guitar, his upcoming record, which is going to have in the title, and we could look forward to that. Most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play a guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Martin, thank you so much. I appreciate everything.
Thanks for having me, man. This was a lot of fun.
Likewise. Thank you, brother. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.